John Blickman joins me this week to discuss the evolution of homebrew equipment. This is Beersmith Podcast number 298.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 298, and it's early February 2024. John Blickman joins me this week to discuss the evolution of homebrew equipment. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop, March 24th to 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start or grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And also The Barrel Mill, creators of the Infusion Spiral, used to add flavor and aroma to wine, spirits, and beer. Their unique spiral-cut design creates unrivaled surface area in a small package, allowing fast extraction of the toasted oak's aroma and flavor compounds. Looking for woods other than oak? Try their exotic woods, featuring spirals made from Aburana, American and French oak, aspen, Spanish cedar, cypress, and sugar maple. For more information, please go to infusionspiral.com. Again, that's infusionspiral.com. And Beersmith for the Web, the online version of Beersmith brewing software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes for any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of brewing tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder, click those like and subscribe buttons on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back John Blickman. John is the founder and president of Blickman Engineering, a provider of premium home brewing and professional brewing equipment. John has helped hundreds of brewers start craft breweries. John, how are you doing today?
Doing well. It's we're past the winter cold part, I hope, and heading into spring here in Indiana. So nice weather out, and spending the cold months inventing and creating. So it's been
awesome.
Good.
Yeah, I've been disappointed. I wanted to go skiing, and the ski season was like 3 days here, I think, and that was it. And it was disappointing. We had one snowstorm. That was it.
But we had maybe 3 inches of snow the whole winter. It was kind of a dud.
Yeah.
My parents in Iowa had several feet, so I was jealous.
I need to head out west to go skiing, I guess. But John, what have you been up to the last year? It's been almost a year, actually, since we had you on last.
Yeah, it has been a little bit, hasn't it?
Yep.
Well, just, you know, always working with new products and answering the questions and things that people come in and, you know, and suggestions for products and listening to those. And we've always got some fun new gizmos on the drawing board. So
do you have an example or two maybe?
Well, we've got a really neat for our Pro Series. We've got we've come out with our surface kettles for the home side. So, you know, the heating element is bonded to the bottom of the kettle. And those are very well received. Super happy with those. And we've done the same thing with the Pro side, only they're actually mechanically affixed with studs onto the bottom. So they can be replaced, although they're pretty much going to last a lifetime anyway. We've got a couple of breweries testing them out, and they're loving them. The nice thing is, on our other Pro kettles, you've got those large immersion elements, and those you got to remove and scrub by hand and clean to get them all squeaky clean, so they don't shorten their life or cause any scorching. But with the surface elements on the bottom of the kettle, it's just like cleaning any other kettle. It's pretty straightforward.
It's cool. Very nice. And I know Pro Brewing's become a much bigger portion of the business lately, right?
You know what? It has. You know, I think the whole, most people know the market's kind of leveling off, and I think that's just kind of a natural part of most markets. The smaller end where we participate in, we're still selling product in, and you know, it's that you know, one of the places that's doing some of our testing for us, and they're doing quite well, is a little brewery in Brookston, Indiana, Crazen Brewing, and they've just been doing very, very well. And it's a small farm community, you know, maybe a couple thousand people in the town, maybe, but it draws from a large area of the rural Indiana. So, you know, we hope to see that continue to grow.
Well, that's great. Today, you actually wanted to talk about the evolution of homebrewing, spanning some 30 years back to the 1990s. So I thought I'd start. I know you started homebrewing. What was your first brewing setup? What did that look like?
Oh, my first brewing setup, I had to go out and buy a large, like, 1.5-gallon kettle. And, I mean, it was funny. Unless you went to a commercial restaurant supply place, you really couldn't find large kettles like that. I mean, even now you can find larger kettles in like Walmart, but so I just bought a small, maybe 1.5-gallon 2-gallon kettle, and it was just stovetop, just, you know, on the stovetop at home. You know, it wasn't common to do a burner outside, and full wort boils were not very common at all. And I remember the first homebrew.
Well, you couldn't do them on the stovetop, right?
No, they, you know, your stovetop didn't have enough capability to heat that much water. And turkey fryers weren't really a thing back then.
Nope.
So, you know, there wasn't a ready access of, you know, bigger outdoor burners. So,
yeah, I think something similar for me. I started in 1987, but I had a, you know, I think I found a 2.5-gallon pot, so a fairly large pot. But just like you, on the stovetop was how I did it for many, many years.
Yeah. And you know, and it's kind of interesting because there was hardly anybody doing all grain brewing. It was just like the real homebrewing zealots that would somehow find, you know, a few different types of grain and, you know, some hop cones. You know, pellets weren't even really a thing back then that I recall anyway.
No, the first homebrew shop I went to, they had leaf hops on the shelf, not in a fridge. They were sitting on the shelf, and most of them were brown.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You know, and then it was, a lot of it were these even pre-hopped kits, like, you know, John Bull malt extract kits, you know, that were covered with dust in the homebrew stores. And you'd take the, you know, it was a large can, and you would just take the little plastic top off, and there'd be probably a 10-year-old pack of yeast in there, and then it was all pre-hopped, and you basically just poured that in your kettle and boiled it. And then, you know, they were all concentrated wort boils, so you would just do that. You'd fill your carboy up with a couple of gallons of water and just pour it in there hot, and you know, and then, you know, top it up to the volume you're supposed to. And then you know, if it was in the winter, you kind of took it outside until it got to the temperature you're supposed to. Otherwise, you just kind of hoped it was close enough, and you just pitched your yeast. So it was pretty pretty simple back then. And a lot of people were using just even plastic buckets back then. You know, people still use plastic buckets.
Yeah, that's right. That was it. I had a pot and a plastic bucket, and that was my brewing kit, basically.
Yep, and then just a stir spoon that was a little bit longer for the bigger kettle. That was about it. So, you know, pretty basic. I think I still have the first edition Joy of Homebrewing from Charlie Papazian. And I actually, like, years later, I actually met him, and then I knew I was going to meet him at a show, and I brought my whole book and had him sign it.
That's cool. Yeah. I have the first edition as well. That was one of the first books I bought.
Yeah.
But that brings us to one of the big differences. Stovetop extract was basically the norm for better part of 30 years. I mean, homebrewing was legalized in the United States back in 1977, I believe.
Yeah.
And so for some 30 years, that was the dominant method, really.
Oh, by far. Yeah. You know, and again, it was only the extremists that were all grain brewing, you know, and I just thought this would be a fun hobby. I saw somebody when I lived in Houston working for Caterpillar that was making beer in his house. We just went over some friends. It was my wife's coworker, and we went over there, and he had this cooler full of this oatmeal-y crap going, and I'm like, what are you doing? He says, I'm making beer. So he was one of the zealots that was making beer from all grain. So when I got into it, you know, I just started with the extract kits and eventually thought, well, you know, when I get this all figured out, I'll definitely try the all grain thing. You know, and back then too, having a bad batch wasn't that uncommon. And now, you know, contrast that to now, and it's very rare to have a bad batch, you know, unless you're careless, but it's very easy. Let me put it this way. It's very easy to make a really great contamination-free beer.
Yeah. Well, another challenge, and we talked a little bit about Papasian's book, but the knowledge was really pretty limited back then. Even if you go back and look at Papasian's book, it says like, you know, dry hop, or it says like, you know, boil hops. It doesn't say how long. It doesn't say how much. It's just, it's kind of vague. And that's, you know, that was a real problem back then, but it started to change in the 1990s, didn't it?
It really did. I actually started in 91 or 92 brewing, and we had a store down in Indianapolis, so that was like an hour drive for me to get down to the store. We had a little teeny one in Lafayette for a very short period of time. It was one of the guys in our kind of local, loosely affiliated homebrew club. I think it was called Bovines, kind of a weird name for a homebrew store. But anyway, just very few ingredients and very little knowledge out there. The internet really wasn't a thing as far as, you know, having lots of knowledge and outlets for learning about homebrew. YouTube wasn't a thing, none of that. So it was, you know, a lot of that was just talking to people, you know, in a homebrew club, if you even have one, and then just talking to homebrew stores and then books. You know, that was really about the place where you got the information. I don't even remember seeing even a recipe book back then. You would just have, you know, just some that were in the back of Charlie's book, but, you know, it wasn't, I don't recall being able to go out and even just buying a book of recipes.
Yeah, I think the first one I think it was Dave Line or something like that, or from the UK. And they had a number of recipes that most of which I couldn't duplicate because a lot of them were all grain, actually. So it was interesting. in the 90s, a lot of the equipment was cobbled together as well, wasn't it? Home build things. Like I built a chiller that I used for, probably 20 years now.
I did the same thing out of a garden hose and a piece of copper and wrapping it around I think I wrapped mine around a carboy or something,
I used a big coffee can.
Yeah. And just rolled it around there. And, you know, that was the greatest thing. Before that, I had one of the copper immersion chillers that I made. You know, a lot of that stuff you really couldn't even buy. It was pretty much a do-it-yourself kind of hobby. It was like a niche of a niche hobby at that time.
Do you have some other examples of home-built equipment? I know a lot of people got pretty creative.
Well, I tell you, even having a kettle with a drain valve on the bottom was an oddity, you know. And, you know, so people, I remember when people started, you could go to the homebrew store and you could buy a valve that had a couple of O-rings and a nut. And you basically just kind of, you drilled a hole in your kettle with a hole saw or whatever it is you could find. And then you just did this smashed O-ring sandwich and prayed that it didn't leak much. and that was heaven there, because now I didn't have to, try to get a siphon going, lift the thing up so that it could elevate and all that. Pumps really weren't even a thing. People were terrified of pumps because, oh, that's going to contaminate everything. How am I going to get that clean? When I first got a kettle, I ended up getting it at some restaurant supply store outlet and got an old Valrath kettle, and it was a 10 gallon, because I wanted, you know, it was taking time. This is a little bit later, but when I wanted to make 10-gallon batches, so I got a 10-gallon kettle, which was woefully small for that, but didn't have that knowledge base back then. But, you know, and you know, when I did want to start all grain brewing, it was just completely figure out what you can even find to make things out of. People were using rectangular coolers or round coolers and using CPVC pipe that they glued together and hacksawed slits on the bottom and just tried to get whatever they could.
I was saying the ubiquitous cooler, yeah. Igloo cooler, you know, the big 5-gallon water cooler was pretty much the standard mash tun for anybody that wanted to do all grain, right?
Yeah, it sure was. And water chemistry wasn't really even a thing. They sold water salts, like Britain water salts, I remember. But nobody really was, you know, was the knowledge wasn't out there to understand water chemistry and how that affected the mash and all that. So it was, you know, oh, I'm burning English beer. I'll just throw this stuff in my water. And, you know, our water in Lafayette is terribly hard. So then eventually.
So you're throwing more stuff in it, right?
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. Yes. Talk about sharply flavored hot bitterness. But, you know, it was just, you know, not a lot of knowledge out there on that. And I remember finding a water filter because, you know, I heard, oh, you got to take chlorine out of the water. You know, so I got just a house water filter with a
charcoal.
Yeah, the carbon filters on it, and that removed that. You know, so it was always that. Try to do something a little bit better the next batch. And, you know, and I, being the gear junkie, obviously, you know, I was cobbling together a 3-tier system because, again, pumps were not a thing back then. You know, so if you're going to all grain brew and, you know, there was no brew in a bag, there was no, it was like you had to do a 3-vessel brewing. So I.
And it had to be gravity fed, right?
Oh, yeah. Gravity fed. So, I picked up some, you know, shelf brackets and things from Home Depot or wherever it was, and just cobbled together something that I could disassemble pretty quickly because I didn't have a lot of space to store all that. We had a garage, but I also had a woodworking hobby and home remodeling and all sorts of different stuff. So, you know, I look back and I go, man, that was some dangerous crap, but you know, it was like getting a bucket of hot water filled and then you had, you know, to scoop it up and pour it in the hot liquor tank so that it would get high enough, you know, because you only had, you know, then at that time, you know, I was brewing outside, you know, and had a burner. So I had a burner for the kettle that was on brew kettle that was on the bottom, but I had to heat it there. Didn't have a pump. So I'm scooping it out with a saucepan, big saucepan, and trying to get it up to the top kettle and keeping everything going. It was quite a ordeal, you know, standing on stools and all that crazy stuff. But hey, it made beer.
There was another interesting thing going on here. So in the early 90s, we saw the early internet start to grow. And it was probably about 95 before we really start to see more widespread use of web browsers and stuff. But there were news groups before that, including groups for brewing, which kind of dominated the discussion. And then as we get into the later 90s, the information does start to grow, and one of the interesting things, though, and I mentioned this in a number of my talks, but the conversation, because it was, you know, done on this early internet, was dominated by technical people, and that had implications for the evolution of brewing, really.
Yeah, don't you think? Sure did. You know, when you could go from just a, you know, an obscure old book that you could find at Barnes and Nobles or wherever, and, you know, be able to interact with people who brought certain skills and knowledge to the hobby was just, I mean, revolutionary, really.
Yep. And we saw, you know, John Palmer, I think, published his book in the late 90s. He was selling them out of his garage originally. The, you know, pretty amazing story there.
Yeah, absolutely was. It took me a little while to get rolling on doing equipment, but I started that whole routine in my garage as well, just out of necessity and, you know, and also just, you know, some suggestions from homebrew stores. But that was another thing. Homebrew stores started popping up in all sorts of different places because, you know, these people that were brewing and then thought, well, geez, I can start a store and sell some of this stuff. And, you know, so we start, you know, we started seeing a bit, you know, a growth of homebrew stores too.
Yeah. And that led up to about 2000. And there was a little bit of a shakeout around 2000, if I recall, right?
A little bit. Yeah. And that was just before I got started. I think I started selling things in like 2001 or 2002. And, you know, that by then the homebrew stores were pretty well established. You could get reasonable variety of malts, you know, and then lots of information in books. I think Palmer actually started his book as an online book.
It was online originally. Yeah, that's true.
And then eventually published it, you know, in a book format. And that's where I learned just a lot of different stuff, is reading that book from, you know, that talked about things in a more technical manner, as opposed to like a, you know, a cooking recipe book.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what, you know, a decent bit of the stuff was back then. So, I mean, the knowledge at that point just started exploding. And you know, with the internet, you know, being, you know, much more advanced than in the early 90s, it was just super easy to get information, share information. And, you know, the quality of the beer from, you know, the homebrew club meetings I'd go to and everything just started improving very quickly.
Yeah, I launched Beersmith in 2003, and I think you launched Blickman Engineering, right? Or, you know, in that same era. How did you get into building equipment, and when did you actually make the leap to start Blickman Engineering?
Well, I ended up, you know, at that time, you know, had started a family, and I had a lot less time, and I, you know, I thought, you know, I'm going to get into 10-gallon batch brewing. You know, if you're going to do all grain brewing, why not just make 10 gallons? In fact, it was very unusual for people to make 5-gallon batches of all grain, because it was a lot of effort compared to, you know, just an extract batch. And so I had that woefully undersized 10-gallon kettle, but I just kind of made as much as I could and just added a little water to make up for the difference. But one thing, you know, that I didn't have, I was tired of having all these different carboys and having to, you know, because back then too, secondary fermentation was a thing for ales. You let that finish out for a week, and then you had to transfer that to another carboy or bucket and let that sit for another week. And then you could go on to the bottling stage. There was no letting it sit for, you know, 10 days to a week to 2 weeks in the primary fermenter and then bottling it up. You know, something terrible is going to happen. You know, and later on we realized that's not exactly the case. But so I had this, I found a 10-gallon or 12-gallon Nalgene, high-density polyethylene jug, basically, with a large jug top.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it had a valve in the bottom, which I thought was pretty neat. And I made a couple of really good batches in that. And then all of a sudden I started having contaminations, and I realized, well, it's easy to scratch that thing inside when you're cleaning it. And the valve was near impossible to get out and disassemble properly. And, you know, then I thought, you know, and then all this transferring, you know, geez, I've seen these conical fermenters, and I thought that'd be neat. I can just drop the yeast and not have to make a transfer, and it's big enough. So, you know, Toledo Metal Spinning was a place that made these, the base tank itself. And so I thought, well, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to buy I wanted two of those, so I could, you know, have a couple batches going, maybe a lager in the winter that I could put in my basement. And, I thought, but I'll make five, and I'll sell three on this new thing called eBay. And that's how I was going to pay for the other two. And that's how I was going to slide this whole idea past my wife.
Okay.
And I ended little up
did
going
she,
down.
Little did she know.
Yeah, little did she know. Little did I know. Yeah, this wasn't planned from the start. This just kind of organically happened. But so I went down to my local homebrew store and was talking to him about it. And, you know, the gal that owned the store, Great Fermentations is the store. And Anita Johnson Z was the owner at that time. Now her son, Brian, has taken it over. But she said, you know, you seem like a pretty crafty guy. Have you ever thought of developing products for this industry and selling them through the homebrew stores, because really there's pretty much very few people that are developing products for this industry. And, you know, I was an engineer at CAD at the time and, you know, knew all of our suppliers, you know, that we'd worked with, you know, around Indiana and even in Lafayette where I am. And I thought, yeah, you know, I think I could give that a shot. So I started just, I made the units that I wanted for myself and kind of tweaked them and played with them a little bit, and then started selling them through the retailers. I just looked at the back of the Zymergy magazine and started calling retailers in there, asking if they wanted to distribute conicals that I was making. And most of them laughed and said, nobody's going to spend that kind of money. Geez, I think at that time, the conicals were selling for like, well, less than $300. And nobody's going to spend that kind of money on this hobby. They're the cheapest bastards on the planet, blah, blah. But every once in a while, I get one that said, yeah, I'll try to sell one for you. And that's where it started, and it just kept growing. And, you know, fast forward, there's so many, you know, now it's not an unusual thing to have for somebody to have a conical fermenter in their brewery. And before it was
so
just...
So were these all stainless, I guess?
Yeah, they were stainless steel. And everything was NPT back then, you know, because that's fittings and things that people could get. You know, doing the tri-clamp things, well, that was for a big commercial brewery and dairies and all that other stuff. So tri-clamps didn't show up on the scene till probably, I don't know, probably commonly probably like the 2008 to 2010 range.
Right. So when did you start? When did you actually sell your first conical?
First one was in 2022, I think. And I was just putting those things together in
my
garage.
No, that can't be right. 2002,
oh,
maybe.
2002, sorry. No, I haven't been drinking yet today. Just water.
Yeah.
Or this might be a glass of vodka, as far as you know.
So 2002, so you've been doing this a little over 20 years now.
Yeah, I think if I look at, I may have sold some in 20, or in 2000, late 2001. But I formed Blickman Engineering LLC in 2002. So, yeah, so it's been what? Going a little
21
over,
yeah, years.
22 years, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. We had our 20th year anniversary last fall, actually, for Beersmith.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
So,
so you started with that, and then I assume you quickly expanded the line, it looks like, right?
Yeah. You know, again, it was just, you know, it was low-hanging fruit. You know, one of the other things was, you know, cooling 10 gallons of beer at a time was, it just took forever, used tons of water, and really, you know, immersion chillers were the thing, or those counterflow chillers with the garden hoses. But those things, even those were fairly slow because they had such high restriction in them, and people, a lot of people were not using pumps still. My second product was a plate chiller. As an engineer at Caterpillar, and we used plate chillers for engine cooling and oil coolers and all sorts of different stuff. And I learned a few tricks of the trade there. And you know, we came out with the very first plate chiller for the market, and it would actually cool. You know, depending on your cooling water temperature, it'd cool up to 2 gallons a minute. So I could cool that 10-gallon batch 5 minutes and use significantly less water and take significantly less time. You know, people were just terrified, oh, that's going to cause all sorts of contaminations. And, you know, I'm kind of thinking, well, commercial breweries and dairies and everybody else have been using these things for years, and they rarely take those apart.
Yeah, plate chillers are really a standard, aren't they, for commercial, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's, I don't think I've seen a commercial brewery that doesn't have a plate chiller that they're using. But so, you know, that ended up being a really good product for us. You know, most people, you know, thought I was blowing smoke that it'd chill that fast, and people were like, damn, this thing's pretty awesome. So, you know, it was that. And then one of the next products was the beer gun. And I had tried, you know, because I wanted to put my beer in bottles so that I could save it, I could bring it to friends and all that other stuff, because at that time I was kegging, and it was nice to not have the sediment in there, you know. So instead of bottle conditioning, I could just counter pressure fill it. So I went through about two or three different types of these counter pressure bottle fillers and, trying to bottle that in my kitchen. And the wife said, if you spray beer on the ceiling one more time, you're done.
Well, the original counter pressure fillers were pretty complicated. They were based on commercial designs. You had to turn about 10 valves in particular sequence in order to get the thing to work. And like you said, they often leaked and sprayed all over the place.
Yeah, it was. So I thought, well, there's got to be a better way. And so I do a lot of dog walking, and that's my thinking time. So I just kind of thought about, well, what really is the root problem here? And, and it really is CO2 coming out of solution. Why does CO2 come out of solution? Because it hits a large change in pressure or change in direction or change in temperature. So, well, I think I can have that eliminate those things, and I can do it without having to pressurize the bottle. And there was the birth of the beer gun. And that was another one where, I wasn't even sure it was going to work when I built the first one and was very pleasantly surprised. And I had Northern Brewer, the guys up there I had a good relationship with selling things through them. And they did some field testing, and they thought this is great. So the beer gun probably ended up being the product that people know us the most for, and kind of, got the name Blickman Engineering out there. And I think it was like, I think when we first started making them way back then, they were like $80. So it was a reasonably priced product for people to pick up and buy.
Yeah. Especially somebody who's doing the kegging already.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. When did you actually go full time? When did you quit your job at Caterpillar and make the leap to Blickman Engineering?
I think it was August of 2002 is when I,
so pretty early on. I mean, that's right at the beginning, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, I'd been maybe going, I started selling the Conicals and was doing that for maybe a year before I actually formed the company. So, as far as a legal entity. And, so that was probably, that first, year. So it was August. And it was an interesting story. So we had little kids at home. In fact, we just had one that was in preschool. Then we had one that was in like kindergarten, one that was in first grade. And my wife had been staying home with the kids, and she was an engineer at CAT too, and quit to stay home with the kids. And, she was thinking about, okay, well, we're going to have, our youngest in kindergarten next year. Maybe it's time for me to start thinking about getting back to work. And I was thinking, maybe it's time I really get serious with this business and start growing, because I really enjoyed doing it. Not only, it wasn't like it was my hobby, was still homebrewing beer, but what I really liked doing was designing and manufacturing and that part of it. And I actually loved the business side of it too, and the marketing side. That was a lot of fun. So I said, well, why don't you go back and I stay home? So when I first, we had basically a 2-week overlap at Caterpillar. So we, continued to have benefits, and people thought I was crazy for leaving Cat, engineering supervisor at the time when I left, and, thought I was crazy leaving that. And I was like, well, you may be right, but I'm going to do it anyway. And it was great, and it was really fun because it was kind of a part-time job back then, so I could spend time, with the kids, particularly in the summer. And, and homebrewing was a little slower in the summer anyway. So it was a great experience to have that time at home with the girls and just make those good memories and stuff. And, and then it just grew and grew, and I fairly quickly had a sizable full-time job on my hands, and, hired my first person, I think maybe a year or two later. And then it just kind of kept growing and growing.
It's kind of scary making that leap, though, isn't it? I did the same. I did the same thing, but it was quite a bit later, 2010. But
yeah, and I outgrew my garage, so I found a little shed that I could rent from somebody, so I could, buy parts in higher quantities and get better pricing. And I think, well, that's affordable, but it's kind of a pain because it's clear across town, And then it got to a point where it was pretty clear I needed to lease the space. And I think the first place was maybe 2,000 square feet, if I'm remembering right. And it was like $800 a month. And I'm thinking, man, this place is cavernous. And, you know, $800 a month, man. And, you know, but I was like, well, I'm going to do it. I just had to sign a 1-year lease. And I can't believe how quickly we filled it up.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, you got
it. It is amazing. Yeah.
Equipment intense business. So, yeah. Now, as we get into the same time period, we already mentioned that a lot of advanced brewers actually started doing all grain, and they started cobbling together 3-tier systems with pumps that kind of mimicked what you might see in a commercial brewery. Now, you started to offer products in that area as well, right?
Yeah. In fact, I think the first company I remember making the 3-tier stands commercially was Morebeer. They called it their brew sculptures. And they were very nice pieces of equipment. Mm-hmm. And you're right, about that time, pumps started becoming a thing. Well, I mean, pumps were always out there, but homebrewers started getting more comfortable with pumps. And the March pump was the one that somehow, I think it was one of the retailers kind of started working with them. I can't remember if it was Morebeer or if it was Northern Brewer. But they started selling the March pump. And that pump was actually for a hot water heating system for homes and small commercial places. So it was a circulating pump, hot water circulating pump, and for hydronic heating systems. And the attractive part of it was you could take them apart. There was 8 screws you had to disassemble to take it apart, but you could take it apart and clean it and be pretty confident that you weren't going to have a contamination issue. Mm-hmm. And they were magnetic drive, but that a lot of that had to do with the ability to service them in place in a in that kind of setting that they were being used in the hydronic setup. So So that became a real popular pump.
You started making full kettle systems too. I mean, beautiful kettles, right?
Yeah, I think it was about 2006. We started, we made basically the first production homebrewing kettle. Polarware made one where you could get it with just a valve and maybe a thermometer. I think that was about all they offered. But we took one. The Boilermaker became the first purpose-designed kettle for homebrewing, where we started with a clean sheet of paper with the ledge for the false bottom and, the orienting the handles. So in the, angle facing you, our false bottom, we did something different than the traditional perforated, because the perforated was, those things can be a pain to get all the grain bits out of and all that. And they're a little bit more prone to plugging. So we had the button louver false bottom. We put level gauges, glass level gauges on everything so you could see, because at that time, I was realizing that measurement is a very important thing for consistency. And, hacking a mark on your stir spoon isn't the most accurate way to measure volumes. And that was, to me, is really important. And it helped me be really repetitive with my brewing. So it was really nice being, being a home brewer. Then I knew all the things that were a pain in the butt or that could improve your beer. And then we just developed products for them.
And they were kind of the Cadillac for homebrewers, right? I mean, these things were, heavy gauge steel, almost bulletproof, systems.
Yeah. And we eventually
made in the U.S. too, I think, right? The original ones?
The very original ones were imported because we just weren't big enough to afford the tooling. And then, we sold enough of those, we saved enough money, and then we bought the tooling and had them made in the U.S. So, now they're up through the 20-gallon. We just didn't sell enough of the 30 and 55s to justify the tooling, which was very expensive for something of that size.
Yeah.
So they're made out of U.S.-made steel and manufactured out of one piece, so they're non-welded. And we give them a lifetime warranty. So it's been fun watching the development of that. And, and even the development of, pumps, so then everything was vertical, and we came out with our top tier stand, and, it was an adjustable one with a big aluminum post in the middle that you could, you know, adjust them and change it how you wanted to brew. And eventually people were so comfortable using pumps, everything then all of a sudden became horizontal. Still a three vessel, but they knew that, geez, I'll just get another pump, then I can move from one vessel to another, or just, you know, use the one pump and just keep moving it. And, you know, so it was interesting to see how that shifted from all gravity to gravity with pump, because now you could pump your hot liquor up to your hot liquor tank from your boil kettle instead of the less than safe way that we had to do it, you know, a long time ago. And then it became all horizontal, but interestingly still three vessel brewing.
As we get a little bit, as we move a little farther forward, like in the 2013 timeframe, we see double digit growth in home brewing, explosive growth in home brewing, really that kind of peaked around 2013. But we also see for the very first time, the majority of brewers are all grain brewers, which is a big change.
Yeah, absolutely. It, you know, it's, so it was interesting to watch how, most people would start brewing extract. And, you know, way back in the, you know, in the early 90s, people would just brew extract, and that's just what they did. They never did go to all grain. Now it was like people would, you know, in that 2013 range, people might do a batch or two extract, decide that they like it, and then very soon after go to all grain brewing. And, you know, a lot of that was because it was much more common. You could talk to people about it. There was lots of forums and different things. And, you know, and fast forward to, you know, 2016, 17, maybe even 18, people were just starting out with all grain brewing. And, you know, we saw the development of single vessel brewing and both brew in a bag start. I think that mostly started in Australia, if I recall, the brew in a bag process. And then there was Spital came out with a single vessel system. Which, you know, that you still, you kind of have a vessel in a vessel. So, but it's a all in one is what they are now called, I guess. And then, you know, there's a just a number of different, Grainfather was one that popped up, which was, very affordable. We developed one with our Anvil Brewing line, the Foundry, that was even more affordable. And, you know, and it just became so much easier and so much more approachable to just start all grain brewing.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I one of the other things, of course, happened is a big decline, right? We saw home brewing decline about 4% a year from 2013 to today, honestly. And so, I mean, it's almost at half the level it was perhaps at the 2013 peak. We aren't necessarily seeing a lot of brewers get out of the business, but they are starting to brew less. And so then, you know, there's been a move towards smaller systems. And of course, the all-in-one system that you mentioned has kind of become the dominant style, particularly post-COVID. We probably ought to talk briefly about, you know, kind of the impact that COVID had on home brewing.
Oh, yeah. COVID was just very interesting and challenging. Let's just put it that way. we had, it was like almost overnight, we had lots of people not working. And it's been funny. The Brewing Association plotted adult unemployment rate against Google searches for home brewing, and there was a direct correlation. So the more unemployment there was, the more home brewing there was going on. So COVID, it was like this thing on steroids times 10, where we just all of a sudden had a lot of people that were not working and, you know, can't get beer very easily, can't go out to a pub and have a beer. You know, so they, you know, so that part of it just exploded. And then simultaneously, the ports got jammed up. So there was just, you know, you just couldn't get product in, you know, so we were, you know, we just had this demand and, you know, we'd order all these things and we just never knew when we were going to get it. So our lead times went from a very predictable, you know, eight to 10 weeks to get, you know, product from, international suppliers and usually 4 weeks to get product from domestic suppliers to 16 weeks to even 20 weeks in the U.S. and, 6 to 9 months for international things at times. And sometimes they get there and they would sit in the port for months. And, you know, people would just be frustrated. Well, can't you just go there and get it? I'm like, I don't really want to get shot by the port authority.
And if you've been to a port, you don't know which of the billions of containers it's in here.
Well, I know, and it was interesting. So there'd be things in there. It was such a mess. It was just, I think, just terribly mismanaged. But containers would get in there, and they would just grab the ones that just came in because the other ones they couldn't get to because the new ones were in the way. And they just could never dig out the ones that were in the back. So we had some stuck out in the back. And, you know, so it was very challenging. In fact, we did, and justifiably so, customers would get very upset because they'd order something or want to order something. It was always out of stock. And it took a while for customers in the market to understand really what was going on, that it wasn't that we didn't order them. And it wasn't that we didn't, that we didn't plan to have them come in a timely manner. It's just, we had no control over it.
Yeah.
And we actually ran a promotion to kind of drive that point home where, and this was like with our foundries, our Anvil foundries were real popular. They were just super easy to use, very reasonably priced. And that's our all-in-one system.
Mm-hmm.
And we advertised, if you guess the day, if you place an order, a pre-order, and you guess the day that it clears the port, you get yours for free. And I think it was that people really understood. They're really not in control of this.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was just a managed crash, and then the price of, the shipping rates, both international and domestic, more than tripled during those times.
Yeah, it's astounding.
So then prices were going up and people were like, what are you, not only is it late, you're charging me more. And, it was just a mess. And then when in 2021 and 22, when we were having, high rates of inflation, that was another thing where, it was just, the things were inflating so quickly. It was just so hard to keep up with,
the suppliers, yeah.
The suppliers and keep up with pricing, because you still have to make money so you can buy more product that's coming in. So it was very challenging. But and then, this things grew significantly in those times, it's a good kind of problem to have. It can be frustrating both for us and obviously for the consumer who, they were at home, they just wanted to brew beer and we wanted to help them. And, it was an interesting hand we were all dealt.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
The aftermath has been interesting, particularly from a social perspective as well. For example, I have a 10-gallon Brew Easy, which I absolutely love, but one of your systems, but I don't brew on it that much anymore because we just don't have people over to our house at the same rate we did before, or I don't go to events. There aren't as many events as there were before COVID. It seems to be, like the whole social environment around brewing has really changed quite a bit.
Yeah, even with, homebrew clubs, and a lot of that homebrew club thing went online to a degree, like Brewing Network, they had their own homebrew club.
Yeah, I did dozens of presentations to different homebrew clubs during COVID because, we could do them online.
Yeah, it still doesn't have that in-person feel where you can, really
exchange beers.
Yeah, intermingle, talk about different things, try different techniques, that kind of, you had to actively search that out instead of just happening when you're getting together and, having fun and talking to brewers,
Yeah. Well, I think the move to the all-in-one smaller systems, a lot of 5-gallon all-in-one, kind of tabletop systems is a reflection of that as well. Where do you think homebrewing might go next and homebrew equipment might go next, John?
We're starting to see, at least more people talking about, smaller, even smaller than 5 gallons. We have a 2.5-gallon batch size, 2 to 3 gallon batch size system. And, it's always been a fairly small portion, but we're just seeing a little bit more interest in that. 5 gallons still dominate, and 10 gallon is, you know, it just kind of is not nearly as common these days. It used to be for all grain, you know, the
that
thing.
That was a standard size, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, and now it's 5 gallons. A lot of it is. It's just easier. There's not as much muss and fuss with it. There's less cleanup and equipment because you've got one vessel.
We're almost rolling back to the stovetop batches again, right? It all comes around.
Yeah, it's an interesting tangle, but you still don't see very many people brewing extract. Maybe like their first batch or two, but it's not real common.
Yeah, so that is a long-term change, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the other interesting things is, you know, the cost of craft beer has really gone up. And it used to be in the US anyway, people homebrewed because it was just a fun hobby to do.
It was impossible to get a lot of the beers that you can find now, but hard to get at that time.
Right. And in Australia, a lot of people homebrewed because the beer was so expensive. A lot of that had to do with taxation. But a lot of people brewed to, you know, just have a more economical beer. And, you know, and now I'm thinking, geez, and you go to the grocery stores and it's, you know, upwards of $10 for a six pack. And it's like, man, I can brew that for a lot less at home these days.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, have we become, the ones where it's, you know, brew at home to save money?
Well, and as you point out, homebrewers are notoriously cheap, right?
You know, it really kind of started out that way. And, you know, a lot of people thought I was crazy selling, you know, this high-end equipment. But there really is, it's such a broad group of people. If any of you've had the chance to go to a homebrew club or one of the conventions that we've had, you really just see people from all walks of life, you know, very wealthy people, you know, people who are, you know, just, you know, paycheck to paycheck, every type of person you can manage. And that's one of the things that I really liked about the hobby that I didn't think of when I first started it, but man, it's just a great way to meet all sorts of different people and, you know, just make friends you'll have for the rest of your life. But it's been interesting how you've got people that, well, this is their hobby. They're not afraid to spend money on their hobby. And then you've got people that, you know, this is just one of my many hobbies and I just kind of want something that'll just get the job done. And, you know, we try to develop products for both of those industries, our Anvil brand, with the people that just want to get the job done and do it well, and the Blickman, and for people that, you know, like the shiny chrome on their Harley and, you know, want to have, you know, the best there is. So it's been interesting how it's broadened over the years. It used to be just the real thrifty folks.
Well, John, I just looked at the clock and we are running out of time. So maybe that's a good note to end on. I think that was a good point you brought up at the end. I'd like to thank you for coming on the show, though, John. Thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for the invite. Just happy to do it anytime you need.
Today, my guest is John Blickman. He's the founder of Blickman Engineering, makers of high-end professional and homebrewing equipment. Thanks again, John.
My pleasure.
A big thank you to John Blickman for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They invite you to join their upcoming brewery workshop March 24th to 27th in Austin, Texas. This one-of-a-kind event brings together professional brewers to help you start and grow your own craft brewery. To learn more, please visit breweryworkshop.com. Again, that's breweryworkshop.com. And also the Barrel Mill, creators of the Infusion Spiral, used to add flavor and aroma to wine, spirits, and beer. Their unique spiral cut design creates unrivaled surface area in a small package, allowing fast extraction of the toasted oak's aroma and flavor compounds. Looking for woods other than oak? Try their exotic woods. They have spirals made from Amberana, American and French oak, aspen, Spanish cedar, cypress, and sugar maple. For more information, go to infusionspiral.com. Again, that's infusionspiral.com. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder, click those like and subscribe buttons on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. because it's a great way to support the show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.